important thing. We're going to come back to in a few minutes what happens in the next paraglam and dalad, the abduction of Dina. But we also see in Parshas Vayishlach, we also see the death of Rivka. The pasuk tells us that Rivka dies baderech. We know that later it's how Yaakov describes that Rivka dies. She dies baderech, on the path. What does that mean? What is the death of Rivka? We see here, if you have a chumash, Perek Lamed Hey, page 186, pasuk ches. So the pasuk tells us that first, Vatamas Devorah Meinakas Rivka. First, you have the death of Devorah, and here you have a Kadosh Baruch Hu constantly the rest of the parsha blessing and renaming Yaakov, and at the end of page 188. You have the death of Thomas Rachel. During the birth of Binyamin, we find Rachel dying. So what is significant about the death of Rachel? So last week, we spent some time talking about how Rachel gives the signs, how Rachel saves the day. She doesn't want to embarrass her sister. But what do we learn from the death of Rachel? And later, in a few weeks, when Yaakov is describing to Yosef what happened to his mother, he says she dies baderech. Well, there's a lot to talk about. I'll just share it with you from Rabbanit Rimon, who gives a fascinating idea. And she says that Rachel's life is constantly grappling with a process. From Rachel, we learn the significance of a process. Not that there's a goal that we always achieve, but that there's a process. Where do we see that? With motherhood. Right? Rachel is the matriarch who davens for her children, Rachel mevaka al baneha. And yet it is Rachel who doesn't really get to be a mother. She dies during the childbirth of Binyamin. Rachel is the mother that teaches us about tefillah. She undergoes a significant process that brings her to a profound awareness that she can appeal to God, to daven, that only prayer is so powerful that God hears it. She symbolizes what it means to live a life of hope. That exile is not part of our process, not its conclusion. And that's why when the Jews on exile, as they leave Israel, what is it that they have to see? What image lifts up the Jews' hearts as they are led out of Yerushalayim, as they're led to Bavel? They don't see the Kotel, they see Kever Rachel. Because Kever Rachel reminded the Jews that Judaism is a process. There's going to be high moments, there's going to be low moments. There's going to be moments of great accomplishments and blatant miracles and overt hand of God, and we're going to celebrate and sing Hallel and dance together. And there's going to be moments of pogroms and persecutions and expulsions and running from one country to the next. And it's all part of Jewish history. So when the Jewish people see Rachel's kever, when they see Rachel symbolize process, they understand the same way that we went out, we're going to come back in. The same way that there have been, we're coming in a few weeks of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the last miracle that the Jewish people see before they have their big exile. Hashem is telling them, even during moments of darkness, you're in a process. That exile is a process of Jewish history. And that's what Rachel represents. And that's why the Jews have to see Kever Rachel. They don't see Maris HaMachpelah. They don't see where Moshe is buried. They have to see Rachel, who symbolized that our life is a journey. The truth is that it's something that we come back to actually when we get to Shemos, that Moshe Rabbeinu, part of his argument against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that when Moshe says, I don't want to take the Jews out. It wasn't that Moshe had better things to do, or your schedule is already full. What are you going to do? I'm already out of a full schedule. I can't take the Jews out of Mitzrayim. Part of Moshe's argument was, if I take them out, Jewish history is going to come next. Everything's going to happen. Spies, Beis HaMikdash burning, terrible moments. I don't want that. Send Eliyahu HaNavi, we'll go straight to Israel with Mashiach. And Hashem says, that's not how it works. It's ups and downs. There's high moments and there's low moments. So that's the death of Rachel. That's the death of Devorah on page 188 to page 190. And then the rest of the parsha really is the legacy, the families of Esav. So what I would like to spend some time on during our shiur today, which we really haven't done in I think a while, is to go back to Perek Lamed Daled. Because I think Perek Lamed Daled, the story, the abduction of Dinah, holds for us, especially in a world of, was not nothing to do with COVID, but in a world of, we'll see, we'll talk about rising anti-Semitism and cases propping up all over the place, especially in the world of social media, this Perek holds an important message for us. So let's look at the story. The story goes as follows. Even if you have a chumash, I'll read a few of the psukim inside. If you have a chumash, you have a stone chumash on page 180, Perek Lamed Daled. Torah tells us, "Vatetzei Dina baslash ayolda liYaakov liros b'vnos aretz." So Dina goes out. Right? We don't have time to go through all of the psukim and exactly what each one means. But Leah, Dina goes out. And what happens? Vayaro so Shchem and Chamor achimin esi aretz. Shchem sees her. Vayikach osa vayishkav osa vayaneha. And Shchem violates her. He violates Dina. And he begins to have feelings for her, emotions for her. I want to marry her. So what happens? He hears what happens, but he keeps silent. So Chamor comes out, the father of Shem, and he says, "Listen, they're very angry, they're very upset. They want to take where they want. It's terrible. It's terrible what just happened." So they devise a plan. They make this ruse. They make a trick. Here's what we'll do. They say, Chamor spoke with them, and he says, Shchem b'ni choshko nafsho, Vitchem, he wants to marry wants to marry Dina. So we say, "Listen, here's what we'll do. You can't marry her. You don't have a bris milah. So make sure everybody gets a bris milah, and then we'll make a wedding and we'll make a big party." Fine. Sounds like a good deal. They decide to go ahead and give themselves a bris milah. The pasuk tells us, "Vayitva divrayim b'nei chamor." Good plan. They go ahead. What happens on day 3 of their recuperation process? They are obviously in a lot of pain, and it's there that in come Shimon and Levi. They're in a lot of pain. So what happens? In come Shimon and Levi, and they completely decimate, annihilate, wipe out everyone, every male. And they take Dina back. The whole thing was a trick. The whole thing was a trick. We were never going to let her marry you. What are you, idiots? But they fell for it. And while they were in pain and while they were sick, in comes Shimon and Levi and wipes out the entire, the people of Shechem. When they get home, Vayomer Yaakov, Shimon, Levi, Achar Temosi. Shimon and Levi come home, and he says, "What in the world, Yaakov said? What did you do? What have you done? You've embarrassed me. They're going to kill us. What are you thinking? You didn't think before you acted. You weren't being careful. You were careless. You were negligent. You were angry. You were revengeful. But you were wrong. You were wrong." And they say, just going to let her treat us. She should just be treated like a harlot. And that's how the parak ends. So there's a lot of questions. If we were learning this in a class setting, we would just go to town with a number of questions that we have. But let's ask two fundamental questions to this story. The first question is, were Shimon and Levi right or wrong for what they did? Were they right or wrong for what they did? And the second question is, based on that answer, what's this conversation at the end? Yaakov says, "What are you doing?" They say, "Well, what should we do?" And that's how it ends. Is Yaakov validating what they did, but just being upset? Is he pretending to be upset? Is he really angry? If he's really angry, why does Yaakov not really respond back to what they say? What's going on? So here we come into a fascinating debate among the commentators. A fascinating debate among the commentators. So you have, for example, a number of opinions that say they were wrong for what they did. That they were wrong for what they did. The Rambam, for example, the Rambam believes, though, that the following. Shimon and Levi acted appropriately at Shechem. The halacha demands that you have to get rid of all evil. This is what we call the obligation of dinim, right? We know that non-Jews have seven mitzvos to do. Seven mitzvos b'nei noach. The one that might take the longest is dinim, the dalet. You have Eiver min Achai, right? You have Birchus Hashem. They can't curse Hashem. They can't steal. They have to set up courts. Then the big three. They can't murder. They can't do idolatry. They can't do adultery. They have to set up court systems. Okay? So they just did a terrible thing. And everybody in Shechem enabled such an act. So it was okay. They're supposed to have this obligation of dinim. They failed. To prevent this abduction of Dina. That was a violation. They were wrong. Everyone was wrong. The Ramban says, no, slow down. He believes that Shimon and Levi were justified in killing who? Shechem and Hamor. They did something wrong. They should get punished. However, who are you, Shimon and Levi, to go ahead and to wipe out everybody else? His argument, the Ramban's argument is, it was wrong for Shimon and Levi to kill everyone in Shechem, but they could kill Shechem and Hamor. The Ramban says that, he adds, even if they deserve to die due to other violations, Shimon and Levi were not, a judge, jury, and executioner. They should have limited to Shechem and Hamor, and that was it. So here you have a major, major debate between the Rambam and between the Ramban. The Rambam saying the whole town violated one of the Shem Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, and if they do that, they are worthy of the death penalty. The Ramban says, no, they did something wrong, and Rav Hirsch as well is very strong in his words that this was not the right act, and that's why when they come home, Yaakov says, what in the world were you thinking? What in the world were you thinking? You were wrong, you embarrassed me, you put our lives at danger, this was wrong. This was wrong. Now, there are many proofs for this. For example, the Ramban, who believes that they were wrong, supports his opinion that Yaakov strongly criticizes Shimon and Levi. Now, the Rambam could answer that that's why the Torah records Shimon and Levi's response, right? Because, no, Yaakov had his argument, right? You ever get an argument with your kids? So, sometimes you get arguments with students. So most of the time we're right as teachers, but sometimes students are right. And then you have to say, you were right. So maybe Yaakov got angry, and that's what the Ramban says. And the Ramban says, no, Shimon and Levi justified their actions. They were able to do what they did. They were not wrong. They were not wrong at all. Now, what's interesting is that if you open to Parshas Vayechi, the Ramban could argue that Yaakov actually does criticize them, because on Yaakov's deathbed, the last words of Yaakov to Shimon and Levi are, you were wrong. You were wrong. And that's an interesting debate. Okay, so let me share with you the Maharal. The Maharal adopts a compromise opinion between the Ramban and between the Rambam. On the one hand, he says, he agrees with the Ramban that the people of Shechem cannot be held accountable because of what those leaders did. On the other hand, he also justifies Shimon and Levi. And listen to what he says. And this Maharal, this piece of the Maharal, is this topic, by the way, is one of the most fundamental civil law discussions in Israel when it comes to civilian casualties. This story in Bereshis with Dina, with Shimon and Levi destroying the people of Shechem, is what is talked about, one of the most fascinating things about when you have a Jewish government for the first time in 2,500 years, was that when we look at all of these things, our moral compass is led by the Torah. So when the Israeli army discussed the civilian casualties, the rabbis at the beginning of the state of Israel were looking at these stories. How do we view these things? So the Maharal says, he adopts this compromise. He argues that the Torah sanctions waging a war when a nation has attacked us. That in such circumstances, we are permitted, perhaps obligated to respond to that other nation's provocation. In responding, we attack the other nation, and we don't distinguish between the guilty and between the innocent. So Shimon HaLevi appropriately responded to Shechem's aggression. Shechem did something wrong. They abducted Dina. That was an act of war. When the Jews respond to an act of war, they are able to take out their vengeance and their response and their retaliation however they see fit. They do not need to distinguish. Now, it happens to me that unfortunately, although, Israel unfortunately and, you know, somewhat, ridiculously is the one that's condemned the most for their, acts on humans, when they're the ones that take the most precautions when they go door to door instead of carpet bombing a town. But the story, they're able to. Now, anything, especially in the world in which we live, the commentators debate this issue, the modern day rabbis, the poskim debate this issue. We're in a constant state of war today. Even if it's not an official war, there might not be an operation fill in the blank. We are at a constant state of war. And no matter what Israel does, somehow they're always going to be condemned. Even, the UN Human Rights Council during Corona didn't have as many sessions, but in their one session a few weeks ago, they made sure to condemn Israel a number of times. Thank God. So it's good to see that the pandemic has not affected the Human Rights Council's moral compass. But this story is where these commentators go to. This idea that we are able, and that's why many believe that we are always in a state of war. So if you were to take modern day Israel and the modern day stories that we have, if anything happens, even if nothing happens, we can retaliate because we're always in a state of war. And that's the Maharal. That's the Maharal making a compromise between the Ramban saying they should not have done it. They should have just attacked the oppressors, Shechem and Hamor. The Rambam saying they were all wrong. And the Maharal saying it depends. If you are responding, you can do what you need. And that's what we have here. That's the story of the abduction of Dina. This camp of the Rambam that said it was okay. The Rambaner of Hirsch say it wasn't okay. And then the Maharal in the middle. But I want to look at the conversation at the end. Listen again to this conversation. Vayomer Yaakov al Shimon ve'al Levi, achar temosi. He says, you've made me... It disgusts me, Lahavi Shani Bioshev Haaretz. Now, Yaakov says, what's going to happen? Vinesfu Alai Vihikuni. What are you doing? Don't start a fight with a bully. We're not strong enough. And if that bully wants to come and fight us back, we're going to lose. Don't start a fight. You can't finish. So you might have, you might have done a little bit of damage to these people now. But if they come back, we're going to lose. They're going to kill us all. They're going to beat us up. They're going to attack us. What were you thinking? So Shimon and Levi respond, "Hachzona yaseh zachosenu. Should we let our sister be treated like this?" Rashi says it's a lashon of hefker. So should we just let her be like nothing, like garbage? One second. Does their response does not seem to make any sense. Meaning, if you were to be a lawyer and have an argument, what does Yaakov say? Yaakov says, and it could be that Yaakov thought it was right in theory, but not right in practice. What are you doing, Shimon and Levi? You put our lives at danger. So how does their response help? Right? It's a fundamental question. If you look at the psukim, this is a big question. If Yaakov says, what are you doing? And they say, what do you mean? We didn't want to let our sister be treated like this. Okay, then Yaakov might say, you know what, you're right. But Yaakov has two layers. He's upset at what they did, but moreover, there is an immediate danger. Right now, your actions are going to put our lives at danger. I might have thought you were right. I might have thought it was the best thing in the world. But it wasn't calculated. It wasn't thought through. You didn't discuss this around the table. And now we're at risk of being in very, very near future of being completely in danger. What were you thinking? So they say, what should we have done? That doesn't answer anything. Doesn't answer anything. So it's very possible. Now, and more than that, I'll add that the Arachaim asked this question. Arachaim HaKadosh says, how is this a response? How does their answer solve anything? Not only that, but the halacha tells us that if an oppressor tells a group of Jews, send over one person specifically, or I'll kill all of you, it's allowed. How could Shimon and Levi answer, what? We didn't want her abuse to go unanswered. How do they address the threat that their actions now brought into Yaakov's family? Says the Arachaim HaKadosh. He says a very powerful suggestion that I think we need to take seriously in light of, as we look around the world, you know, with Corona, one of the byproducts of living in a pandemic is that we are solely focused on a pandemic. You know, today, ESPN every year, they run a fundraiser every day for Jimmy Valvano. You should ever watch his speech, one of the greatest speeches of all time about living a good life. And they raise money for cancer research. They raise over $250 million for cancer research. And today somebody said that in a pandemic, it is the perfect time to make sure you have a fundraiser because a pandemic says, don't worry about this now. There's other things that are happening that we can't lose sight on. And one of those is, of course, the rise of anti-Semitism, both within just the general world, within the social media world, you know, within the fact that you have the CEO of Twitter justifying the fact that the Ayatollah of Iran is allowed to have a Twitter feed that says death to Israel, and other people's tweets are getting censured for some reason, but those tweets are allowed because it's freedom of speech. Okay? So let's understand the Arachaim HaKadosh's answer. He says the following. He suggests the brothers were saying, Yaakov, the opposite is true. Do you think we're going to sit back and that people take advantage of us? He says the words is, Adaraba, Yistakeno ben Aumos, we're going to be in danger, Kishayiru, when the nations will see, Shebizoy Echad Sholat Bivas Yaakov, if the other nations see that they can take a Jew and abuse them and use them and tear them apart and do what they want, and we won't respond, that's even worse. The brothers saying, yes, Yaakov. It's possible the brothers considered their actions as one that would serve notice to everyone else. Having seen what happened to an individual who uses violence against a member of Yaakov's family, maybe other nations would say, you know what? Maybe we're not going to fight back. Maybe we're not going to take the next Jew because he's easy, because he's an easy target. That's their response. And in fact, the Medrash explains Yaakov's criticism. According to one opinion of the Medrash, Yaakov says, you've polluted me, which means there was a barrel of wine, which was clear, and you polluted it. But the brothers say, according to Rabbi Huda Bar Shimon in the Medrash, it's the opposite. There's a barrel of wine that was polluted, and we, the brothers, we purified it. We purified it. This is an amazing, amazing insight of the Arachayim. His answer is suggesting that sometimes we look at it and we say, you know what? Maybe the easiest thing right now is to just not do anything. Let's play dead. Let's just be quiet. Let's go on our way. We don't want to cause any trouble. But really what the Arachaim is saying is that sometimes you have to be able to stand up for yourselves. There's an amazing story. When Yitzhak Shamir was the prime minister of Israel, he was under tremendous pressure to agree to a land for peace proposed by Saudi Arabia in August of 1981. You can look it up. It's called the 8-point plan. Now, Shamir was from the Begin tradition of Jewish pride, but nonetheless, he was on the verge of giving in and compromising on the Israeli national, on Israeli top level Israeli national security. So he agreed to meet with a bunch of Rabbanim from the Dati Lumi camp the day before he went to the United States to meet with Reagan. And one of those Rabbanim was Rav Shlomo Aviner. Rav Shlomo Aviner is a rabbi today, big Marbitz Torah, big answer of Shilas, big post. After meeting, Rav Aviner takes the prime minister aside, takes out a Tanakh, and began to read the psukim, how Hashem gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. And he said, prime minister, just remember Shamir was silent, but Rabbi Nair said he understood what I was trying to tell him. While the prime minister is watching, Rabbi Nair takes the Tanakh and he slips it into the prime minister's briefcase, packs it up, and he goes to the United States. Story continues that after they have this, several days after the negotiations in Washington, Rabbi Nair received a call from the prime minister who told him the following. He says, I want to thank you for reminding me what the Torah says about the land of Israel. When I was meeting with Reagan, they said to me, I had to agree. Agree on this, agree on that. But I asked, what about our security? They promised me millions of dollars in security. I had one objection, another objection. They kept offering millions and millions more to address each of their concerns, each of my concerns. So finally, I thought about it, and I pulled out my Tanakh that you put in my briefcase, and I began reading the psukim in my broken English to President Reagan and everyone else who was at this meeting. And I showed them that God promises to Israel and the Jewish people, and after that, they simply packed up their bags and concluded they could not do anything else with me. So Rabbi Nair, he says, I want to thank you for what you said to me during the meeting. Yaakov's silence in the face of his son's answers shows us that Yaakov conceives that Shimon and Levi's argument is correct. What do I mean by it's correct? By taking this decisive action to avenge Dina's abuse, Yaakov agreed that they were in fact protecting rather than endangering his family. And that's why the next parak tells us, Vayisov, Vayichitas Elokim Alarim, as they set out, there was a terror of God that fell on the other nations, below Rodfu Achrei Bnei Yaakov, and no one else pursued them. That doesn't mean that every act, every zealous act is the right act or permitted, but it's their argument is that it's an approach that we sometimes have to take. Do we lie down? Do we take the abuse? Do we not want to ruffle any feathers? Or do we stand up and do we take action? We've done both. Sometimes in history, we've given in, we've bowed down, we didn't want to upset our enemies, they shouldn't attack us. Throughout exile, we have bowed down to many nations and to many Esavs. And while Yaakov bows down to Esav, Binyamin, who wasn't yet born, never bowed down. That's why later in history, when Haman looks at Mordechai, right, Haman says, why are you not bowing down like your father did to Esav? And Mordechai says, because I'm from Binyamin, and Binyamin never bows. When we look around the world and we see this rise of anti-Semitism, we see the rise of social media in its sowing of hatred among the Jewish people. A recent study showed that over a year span, there were almost four and a half million anti-Semitic tweets shared by 3 million people on Twitter. Right? When we have lawmakers, you know, almost prime ministers of countries who are anti-Semites, when it seems like attacks and swastikas and beatings are commonplace. A survey by the Anti-Defamation League found that 18% of respondents believe that the total worldwide population, 18%, almost a fifth, believe that Jews exceed 700 million Jews. How have I? There's not even 14 million of us. And thank God there have been some good developments. You know, the president signed last year an executive order that all anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And that's a clear, acharte mosil avisheni, right? Sometimes we're like Yaakov. We don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to say anything. We better be quiet. And sometimes we have to say, achzonas achoseinu. No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work like that. You know, my eighth graders in school are beginning their whole the Names on Numbers project. And we talk about the resistance, especially when we take them to the Holocaust Museum. Resistance takes on two forms. There's physical resistance, right? There's ghetto uprisings, and there's fighters, and there's also spiritual resistance, which was Hachzonas Achoseinu. We're not going to give in. We're not going to bow down. There's two responses. And this is the argument between Yaakov and between Shimon and Levi. It means that sometimes we have to get involved. We have to get involved with organizations and institutions that fight anti-Semitism at home, college campuses. You know, maybe one of the blessings in disguise is that not having people on certain campuses right now has led to a little decrease in some of the college campuses and the anti-Zionism that sometimes we feel. You know, when we talk about great leaders, whether, you know, in the Holocaust, from the Sri Deish, Michal Yaakov Weinberg, Refrai Mashri and the Shal of Chubas Mima Makim, Refshir Lib Aronson, the Kleizer Megareba, the Esh Kodesh. These are Shilohs that were asked with Trachsona Yaseh Sachoseinu. We can't let it, we can't sit down. And ultimately, we have to weigh these issues. We take on sometimes both responses to growing anti-Semitism, physical protection, political protection, spiritual protection. But this argument, this debate, this philosophy has a little bit of both. And we're at a time right now where we can't just say, you know what, it's better we don't say anything. It's better that we stand back. It's better that we don't want to ruffle any feathers, because it hasn't led us to a stronger opposition. It's only making us weaker at certain places. So now is the time of Hachzunas Yasa Hoseinu. There are things that we could do. If there are organizations we can join, if there's letters that we can write, if there's bills we can help to talk to our local representatives, these are things, our Shimon and Levi response of Hachzunas Yasa Hoseinu. Yaakov says, you're gonna make it worse. And they say, no. If we don't do anything, we're going to make it worse. We have to stand up. We have to show them that Jewish blood isn't cheap. We have to show them that we're going to take our lives and our brothers and sisters are our family, and we're going to take it seriously. And when we show that, then we hopefully get to the next parak of where nobody wanted to challenge the Jewish people.